Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Michael Rebell. He's the executive director and co-founder of the Campaign for Educational Equity at Columbia University. He's also an attorney who acted as co-counsel in the Campaign for Fiscal Equity case here in New York State. And he was just recently appointed by Governor Cuomo to be on the new New York Education Reform Commission. Michael, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Well, the question of how to collect and then distribute funding for education is a perennial one, and it's been getting a lot of attention lately throughout the state, perhaps even more so upstate. So just to set the stage for us here, could you briefly set forward why the present system is unfair, and if it's possible to qualify this, just how unfair is it?
Well, basically, one can say it's unfair because following the ruling of the Court of Appeals in our CFE case about 5 or 6 years ago, the legislature sat down and committed to providing substantial additional funding to make up for the huge gaps in New York City and especially for high-need districts throughout the state between what the court had determined was the inadequate funding that they were getting at the time and what would be needed for a sound basic education. Sound basic education is the legal term for the constitutional right that every student in this state enjoys. And we had a very clear court ruling at the time that kids were not getting this sound basic education. So the legislature sat down and worked this out, and in their wisdom, they came up with a solution that provided about $9 billion statewide in extra funding that was supposed to be phased in over 4 years. In a nutshell, the funding went forward for about two of those years. Then the recession hit. First, they froze any further phase-in of the promised amounts, and then they started cutting drastically. So, again, to make it very straight and simple, we're back at where we were when the court said the system was unconstitutional, probably a little below that.
Well, so you've given me the distance between where we are now and what the court said, but I guess what I'm really getting at is if you could give me just a thumbnail sketch of why the court was right. I mean, what is the bigger issue here that with the discrepancy between fundings that makes this unfair? One specific example that would be, is this an argument about floors, because you mentioned the basic amount that every child constitutionally entitled to, or is it a question about relative amounts between one district and another?
It's at least according to the court holding, it was based on what we call an adequacy concept. So every child is entitled to whatever is needed to provide this opportunity for sound basic education. Some children may get more than that, but the court's concern was that every child in the state had to get at least that base amount, and that base amount was defined in actually quite substantial terms. It really was key to the kind of education kids need to be capable voters, to be competitive workers in a 21st century world. So it was not a minimum definition. And although you could satisfy that constitutional mandate and still have some disparities in funding among districts, I think most of the high-need districts would be very happy today to get the amounts they were promised under the CFE formula.
Now, that formula in that case, that was limited to particular cities. Is that correct or not?
Well, it primarily benefited New York City and 55 districts throughout the state that were determined to be high needs by the state education department. And that included all of the big five. It includes Syracuse, Rochester, et cetera, and most of the other high need districts.
Okay. Has the case changed the process for education funding beyond those areas, at least the politics of it, if not directly included in that
case?
Well,
the as far as the equity and fairness of the formula is concerned, the formula changes that the legislature adopted in 2007 moved somewhat in the equity direction. Many people would say not far enough. It clearly was not the ideal formula that we were pushing for, but as these things go in the real world of politics and legislative policymaking, it was a giant step forward.
Well, you mentioned the ideal world, and that's exactly where I wanted to go with this next question. Let's say you were building an educational system and the funding for it from scratch. How would you fund it?
I would determine what are the basic services that kids need for a sound basic education, And that's not a simple question, because it obviously includes competence in reading and math and things like that. But if you take seriously things like citizenship, some of the areas of what we call extracurricular activities now, student government, student newspapers, some of the things that are being cut back with the budget slashing we've had, I think those are part of a core sound basic education. Anyhow, I think essentially what the state needs to do is define with more precision the services kids need, and that includes extra services for kids with extra needs. And the court was very clear about the fact that formulas should be based on need. But once you've determined what these services are, then you need to do a cost analysis, what we call a cost study. How many dollars do you need to fund these various basic services? And then you come up with a figure. That's the fair way to do it.
So in terms of the funding piece, though, would it be fair to say that what you would like to see would be essentially a statewide school system, school district, where the funding really is apportioned throughout the state on a basis of need?
I think the basic distribution should very much be keyed to need. I'm not sure that it has to be totally statewide. Some states have moved very far in that direction, and the results have not always been positive. What the court said, and the reason I'm emphasizing this court decision so much, is this is the bedrock constitutional law, and that's been clearly established in the CFE case. The court there made it very clear that the ball stops with the governor and the legislature. The state is ultimately responsible for providing fair funding for all kids. If they choose to allow school districts to raise some of the money, that's fine, but they're responsible for making sure that if they're going to have a contribution based on local property taxes or whatever, that the full amount that the kids need, bottom line, whether it's a combination of state aid, local aid, federal, whatever, it has to be sufficient for sound basic education.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Michael Rebell, the executive director of the Campaign for Educational Equity at Columbia University. Well, I know it's tough to put numbers on some of these things, but I'd like to ask you to do this if you could. In your estimate, how much additional funding for the entire system is required to allow it to provide what you would think would be sufficient educational opportunity for all the state's children?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the legislature had determined in 2007 that the constitutional mandate required an additional $9 billion. And they have provided a little of that for transportation aid and all, but the basic foundation aid, which is the core operating money, we're back where we were before 2007. So you could take those figures and it would be somewhere between $5 and $7 billion statewide. But quite frankly, although from a legal point of view, there's a good argument that since those promises are still on the statute book, they've just been delayed, one could argue that that's what's needed. Personally, I am open to taking it to reality, the economic circumstances we're in. I understand the economic climate is very different from 2007. But you've got to do it in the following way. You've got to say maybe current conditions require us to take a harder look at cost efficiency, cost effectiveness. This is what the governor talks about all the time. And that's fine if you do it in a fair and an efficient way. So that means if you can bring costs down and provide the key services that kids need at a lower price, that's fantastic. And part of that would be getting rid of state mandates. Part of that may be finding ways that school districts that may be inefficient have to be more efficient. I'm all for all of that. But the problem with that is, so far, what the governor has done and most of the legislative leaders is just pontificate about how you need to do more with less without showing us how you can do more with less. He set up a mandate relief commission. We're short over $5 billion in foundation aid. They came up with $125 million in savings, only a third of which went to the education budget anyway. So, you know, that's inconsequential. And I think the governor's got an obligation, if he wants to reduce education funding, to show exactly how we can be more efficient, And again, you're going to have to do a cost analysis on this. If the figures from 2007 don't work, show us figures that do work in a constitutional sense. They have to work in allowing all school districts to provide kids the basic services that they need.
Well, you mentioned before the idea of the appeals court establishing a constitutional right here. And so you've talked a lot about that. You've written about that. And my understanding is you've argued for the establishment of an explicit constitutional right for comprehensive educational opportunity for all children in a way that perhaps is broader even than what we currently have through the state court system. Could you say a bit about that? Is there a broader constitutional right, perhaps at the national level, that you'd want to see?
Well, I think this concept of sound basic education that our court upheld in New York State is not very different from similar concepts that courts in the majority of other states have held up. In New Jersey, they call it thorough and efficient education. In Washington State, it's ample education. In other states, it's adequate education. In Florida, it's high-quality education. But basically, the courts are talking about the same thing, which is the skills you need to be citizens, capable citizens, and competitive workers. And there's some uniformity in the thinking on this because most states, virtually all states, have adopted these academic standards and now in some subjects what we call the Common Core standards, which really define the heart of the basic skills that kids need.
Well, according to your website at the Campaign for Educational Equity, you argue in a recent article that, quote, "The national pursuit of equity and excellence can only be achieved through efforts to eliminate the socioeconomic barriers harming low-income students and ensure that disadvantaged students receive the essential services and supports needed for school success." I was curious to know, doesn't that put into the education system a level of social responsibility that it can't be realistically be held accountable for?
Well, it puts into the education system a certain range of services that some might say might more properly be elsewhere. So let's take health, for example. I don't know that historically schools have been interested in having health clinics and being concerned about their students' health. But on the other hand, we've got these high standards, and we're told every child should achieve, can achieve at these high standards. But you have certain kids, especially coming from certain poverty backgrounds, who may have uncorrected vision problems, who may have asthma. And kids with asthma in the inner city tend to miss about 15% of the days of attendance at school. You miss 15% on top of every other problem you've got. You're not going to have much of a shot at those standards. So if we're meaning what we say about all kids having an opportunity for these standards, you've got to have more health services. You've got to have more extra time on task. You need the after-school programs and all the rest. And that's just a simple fact if we mean what we say with these standards, which, as I say, have been built into these constitutional things. You know, on a wider philosophical basis, the fact is, although some politicians like to make cheap attacks on this, we don't have the social welfare web for poor people that many other advanced countries have. And it's not my business to talk about whether we should have better federal or state health care and child care services. In general, I focus on the education. But the fact is, if the rest of the system doesn't provide these things and you want kids to get ahead educationally, you have to give them a modicum of those services in the schools. And America does believe in its schools. It may not believe in socialized medicine or cradle-to-grave welfare benefits, but the core American dream is built on educational opportunity. So that's why I think politically the public does accept more of these services being organized around schools and more funding for schools to support these services. And I think that's very appropriate given where we are in the United States these days.
And I wanted to join precisely the kind of argument that you just made to this question of the constitutional right then and put the two of them together. If the educational system is carrying that kind of responsibility for opportunity that I think you've just very effectively laid out. And it's also a constitutional right that children have that educational opportunity. I wonder, politically, are you setting up a system that could constitutionally mandate a whole host of social spending and social engineering through the guise of educational opportunity that a lot of Americans would not be very comfortable with, or that politically anyway, there'd be a lot of easy attacks to make on it?
Well, I think most Americans would be very comfortable. If you talk about the specifics, you know, who's going to deny a proper vision screening followed up by giving the glasses? A big problem. Many schools will screen kids' eyes and write them a prescription that they need glasses, but their parents don't have the means or the knowledge about how to do this to follow up with it. So when you focus on issues like that, I doubt people are going to deny it, and I doubt they're going to carry on that this is socialized medicine or whatever these political cliches of the moment are. And, you know, I approach this from what kids need and that the country's national commitment is to high standards, and that also serves a national interest. You know, I believe in equity for all kinds of philosophical reasons, but we also have to be competitive in the world, and people realize that. So I think the public can accept a lot of this.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Michael Rebell, an educational equity advocate from Columbia University. Well, I want to back up a minute and think about this from a broader social perspective and kind of where the public may be on this. Do you think as a society we may be at or at least approaching some kind of tipping point in the confidence in public education, particularly in public education in urban areas?
Well, we've been kind of at that tipping point for the past few years, and I see that this is starting to come out in the presidential election. So I don't want to look at it from the point of view of partisan politics. You know, I thought it was a great thing back in 2001 that we had such strong bipartisan support for the No Child Left Behind Act. That was a real breakthrough. And over the years, many people have been critical of No Child Left Behind, and I've been critical, too much emphasis on testing and some other things. But what was beautiful about No Child Left Behind, and still is, it's still on the books, was a national commitment to overcoming achievement gaps. No Child Left Behind stood for the proposition, which is exactly what the New York Court of Appeals said, that we expect every child to reach these high standards. And at the time, they expected all children to reach it by 2014. They were giving it 12 years. Doesn't look like every child's going to reach it by 2014, but that is still our stated national goal, and it should be. And I would hope that the politicians on both sides would see it that way. One of the problems I have with some of the current debate is the way the concept of choice has kind of been distorted. And it's not so much choice of different ways of reaching the national goals. Some of it is escapism from public systems in a way that doesn't allow the public systems to do their jobs. You know, I think a certain amount of diversity and experimentation is great if that's what it is, but not as a way for undermining the public school system.
Well, I want to follow up on that idea, because one concern that one might have thinking about this is that if you reach a tipping point where people basically just give up on the system's ability to deliver, then is the political constituency for greater fairness then at risk, because the whole issue is just one that people feel is in a sense kind of hopeless.
Yeah, you put your finger on a really good point. It's a critical point. It's a problem with privatization that we've got in so many areas of our lives. And yes, I think it's true. If you had more of a trend toward private schooling or vouchers or whatever, fewer and fewer taxpayers and citizens have a stake in the public school system. And that would be horrendous, and I would argue that also raises serious constitutional terms because, you know, going back to the beginning of our conversation today, the core of what the Court of Appeals, like most other courts around the country, have said, the core purpose of public education is to prepare kids to be capable citizens. Well, that implies a certain amount of common learning, common understanding, common contact, all the things that come from the public schools. If you go back to Horace Mann and the creators of the common school movement in the 19th century, that's what they were always talking about, the beauty of having children, rich and poor, coming together in this beautiful public institution. It was the best of American civics, you might say. And we get away from that at our peril and maybe at our constitutional peril also.
Before we get to the three questions at the end, I also wanted to ask you if you could look into your crystal ball for a second. And do you foresee in the near long term, say the next 15 or 20 years, any kind of major restructuring in the way that we fund education? Or will it kind of do what it's been doing so far, which is to, you know, muddle forward with marginal changes that arguably get us more toward equity as we go?
Well, I would think if you're looking that far down the road, we're going to have substantial trends toward consolidation of school districts. I think you're going to have a much heavier proportion of federal support for education because that becomes really necessary. And aside from that, I think the key decision point is exactly what you put your finger on. Are we going to continue to build our public school system and improve it? Or are we going to move in another direction toward privatization, which really will be consistent with the broader economic trends of the growing distance between the haves and have-nots, and I think would be a very unfortunate direction for America.
Well, let me get to the three questions. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
What did Eric Erickson say in his stages of life? It's looking back and trying to make sense of everything that's gone before.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait, my wife tells me, is I talk too much, but you let me do that today.
And third, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
Well, I think the biggest professional achievement I've had was winning the CFE litigation, and what surprised me the most is that the state hasn't carried through on its promises for providing all the kids the resources they need for that sound basic education that the highest court in the state said was their constitutional right.
That was Michael Rebell. Michael, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.